All right. All right, here's what I want to do. I want to focus in, we'll focus on the area that my scholarship is focused on, which is what has religion to do, not so much with the health outcomes of patients, at least not directly, but what has religion to do with the practice of medicine, with the activities of the practitioners, physicians, and others who engage in the various professions and disciplines that make up the health, the practices of health care. How does religion shape the way we think about what we're up to? Does it shape the decisions we make and the recommendations we make to patients? And that's what I want to focus on here. I want to start with this quotation from Stephen Paget, a famous 19th and early 20th century English surgeon. He said, "Every year young people enter the medical profession who neither are born doctors, nor have any great love of science, nor are helped by name or influence. They find it hard work, ill-thanked, ill-paid. There are times when they say, 'What call had I to be a doctor? I should have done better for myself and my spouse and the children in some other calling.' But they stick to it, and that not only from necessity, but from pride, honor, conviction. And heaven, sooner or later, lets them know what it thinks of them. The information comes quite as a surprise to them, being the first received from any source that they were indeed called to be doctors. And they hesitate to give the name of divine vocation to work paid by the job. Calls, they imagine, should master men, beating down on them. Surely a diploma obtained by hard examination and hard cash and signed and sealed by earthly examiners cannot be a summons from heaven. But it may be. For if a doctor's life may not be a divine vocation, then no life is a vocation, and nothing is divine." In our research, we have found that roughly 3 out of 4 physicians agree with the statement, "For me, the practice of medicine is a calling." So this concept of calling still has deep resonance. By the way, all the data I'm going to show you are on U.S. physicians. Roughly 3 out of 4 U.S. physicians agree with that statement. The concept still has resonance for them. The word calling or vocation has religious origins, as Paget's quotation suggested, and means work to which God calls a person. But in a contemporary context, people often use the term without religious connotation, and indeed in our studies, around half of U.S. physicians who identify themselves as having no religion still identify their work as a call. In the book Habits of the Heart, Bella and colleagues argued that a calling is one of 3 ways in which a person can relate themselves to their work. With the first way being as a job, the second being as a career, and the third as a calling. In general, insofar as, let's say, the practice of medicine is experienced as a job, the work is valued for the material benefits that the work secures. So it's valued for the income it produces, the privileges it gains, and so on. The work is merely a means to those external benefits, but if a physician can obtain the equal amount of those benefits in some other way that has less cost, less burdensome, they will. Insofar as the practice of medicine is experienced as a career, physicians have a little bit deeper commitment to it. They might value it not only for material benefits, but for the way it gives a kind of narrative arc to one's life and a prestige and a way of moving forward, moving up, say, to getting gaining tenure or making a partner in a practice. But insofar as the practice of medicine is experienced as a calling, physicians experience their work as inseparable from who they are and the overall narrative or story of their life. Being a physician becomes has been called by philosophers, a constituting practical identity. The physician works not for money nor for tenure, at least not directly and primarily, but for the fulfillment that comes from the work itself. For for the good of the goods that are internal to the world. Goods like being paying, just attending to those who are sick, and seeking to preserve and restore health. So what I want to do here is consider a case to help us follow several ideas along. LC is a 56-year-old carpenter who presents to his primary care physician after his wife notices that his eyes are yellow. LC has been losing weight and feeling fatigued for a few months. His physician sends for tests, which reveal cancer in the head of the pancreas with metastases to the liver. LC undergoes biliary stenting via ERCP. His primary physician then refers LC to a trusted oncologist but schedules biweekly appointments with herself to make sure LC is receiving the care he needs. So the question would be, in a case like this, in the relationship between LC and LC's physician, what does religion have to do with how LC's physician responds to him? Now, no one believes now, if they ever did, that the encounter between LC and his physician can be reduced to a generic patient with a generic illness, meaning a generic clinician who has access to universally valid scientific evidence. A whole series of movements over the past generation under the heading sort of a patient-centered medicine, which was brought up in the last session, they have emphasized that patients' experiences of illness are shaped by their particular histories, genders, ethnicities, cultures, values, and yes, their religions. So think of the movements for patient-centered medicine, for integrative medicine, holistic medicine, culturally competent medicine, narrative medicine, and spirituality medicine. Each of these movements embraces the influence of patients' individual histories and cultures, including their religious tradition and practices, on their medical decisions and their experiences of illness. But even these movements have tended to keep the focus on the patient and construe the physician in these interactions, at least conventionally, as more or less an interchangeable representative of one biomedical profession. And as representatives of this profession, clinicians are answerable to scientific data and to standards, and they are trained to resist the undue influence of their so-called personal values. As you might expect, this conventional narrative in which the patients are terribly interesting and the clinicians are predictable, evidence-based, and neutral regarding religion and other personal values turns out to be not an accurate description of what happens, at least with respect to religion. But it's not only descriptively inaccurate, this description, it's also, I think, normatively, ethically, theologically problematic for the doctor-patient relationship. If you look just within the world of medical ethics and people who, at least in the United States, who've been interpreters of the practice of medicine over the past generation, physicians and ethicists among them who disagree about all sorts of substantive ethical questions have agreed that in moving away from the problems of an old form of physician paternalism, strong physician paternalism, the pendulum has swung too far toward an emphasis on patient autonomy, in which, as Tim Quill and Howard Brody put it in their paper, quote, "the physician as a person with values and experience has become an impediment to, rather than a resource for, decision-making," end quote. So we've swung culturally toward, away from the idea of doctors knowing best, to such an extent that we're at a point in which the judgment of a clinician is beside the point with respect to the clinician's obligation to competently, and that becomes a dominant term, competently provide healthcare services that the patient chooses. And in different ways, each of these ethicists has insisted that the clinical encounter is and should be characterized less as a transaction between a consumer or client and his or her technician provider. They've in different ways lamented this use of now the dominant language, at least in the United States, we're talking about clinicians, is to call it providers. But that the encounter should be understood more as an encounter in which the physician engages in negotiation, persuasion, seeking out some kind of accommodation, some sort of working agreement with the patient that's mutually acceptable. And the physician does that out of her genuine interest in the patient and her genuine concern for the patient's good, even when she disagrees with the patient about what that good entails. So that's an intro. What I want to do in the time that remains is briefly survey religion-associated differences in physicians' practices. Then I'm going to suggest why I think we shouldn't be surprised to find that religious characteristics of physicians account for quite a bit of the variation in their practices in the different domains, that we should see these as inextricably intertwined. And then close by looking in light of these relationships between religion and the practice of medicine, considering what the profession of medicine might gain from engaging religious traditions and practices as resources for both for discerning what good medicine would look like in our day, and for helping clinicians and other healthcare practitioners become and remain the good practitioners that they aspire to be. So, with respect to the empirical survey, my colleagues and I at the University of Chicago have, over the past 10 years, conducted 6 representative national studies of physicians, 1 of medical students, including now more than 6,000 respondents. And together, these studies have begun to fill in what we have called a virtual Chicago Atlas of religion-associated differences in physicians' practices across an array of clinical domains. If anyone's interested in that work, you can find most of the papers from it at the University of Chicago. So I have just recently moved to Duke University, but the University of Chicago's program on medicine and religion has many of our papers up and has the methods, reports, and instruments if anyone's interested in those. But in the interest of time, I'm going to give just a brief snapshot of some of the findings that have emerged from our research. And I'll start with doctors' religious characteristics. For a long time, the conventional wisdom, at least in the United States, was that physicians were obviously, on average, much less religious than their patients. I heard that many times. And the conventional wisdom was due in part to studies of scientists, which have found that scientists tend to be much less religious than the general population. And it was due in part to broader studies in which those with more education and those with higher incomes tend to be less religious on average. That's a pretty consistent finding in social science research, at least in the United States. But we found in our initial study, and have found consistently since then, that physicians, despite being scientists of a sort, and despite having far above average income and education, are more or less as religious as members of the general population in the United States. On some measures, they appear a bit less religious, so physicians are a little less likely to say, I try hard to carry my religious beliefs over all my other dealings in life. On others, they appear equally or more religious, so doctors are actually a little more likely to attend religious services twice a week or more often. We also found that physicians are more religiously diverse than their patients in the U.S. So as you can see on the right column, 4 out of 5 Americans identify themselves as either Protestant or Catholic. Those percentages may have shifted some in the last decade, but not a lot, most likely. Physicians, with respect to all those religious traditions that are not well represented in the United States, that are minority religions, physicians have a disproportionate number of, physicians are part of those minority traditions. We also found that the majority of physicians self-consciously affirm the influence of religion on their practice of medicine, with 55% agreeing with this statement. And when this initial study came out, we had a series of news reporters called us, and they consistently all asked the question, some form of the question, what is this influence?
How
do their religious beliefs influence their practice of medicine? And we've spent much of the past decade beginning to answer that question. So I'm going to describe four clinical domains in which we've found, this is a snapshot, four clinical domains in which we found religion-associated differences. And to do that, I'll follow our case. 2 weeks after his diagnosis, Elsie returns to see his primary physician. He looks tired and sad. He tearfully notes that he is not sleeping well and he cannot concentrate or enjoy anything, not even being with his grandchildren, because he's so anxious about what lies ahead. "I'm not ready to die," Elsie says. "Why would God do this to me?" Now, George talked in the last session about spiritual assessment and noted that one of the questions is, who should do the spiritual assessment? And within that was the question, what is the role of the physician? It leads to the question for Elsie's doctor, what should she do or say at this point? What kinds of questions might she ask? And where should she turn for help, if anywhere? So the first domain where we find really strong religion-associated differences in doctors' practices that they report and in their ideas about what they should be doing is in the domain of addressing spirituality in the clinical encounter. As you can see in this table, if you can see it, I think some of you can see it, physicians who were more religious or more spiritual were more likely to report each practice of addressing religion or spirituality in the clinical encounter. In general, physician religiosity, self-reported religiosity, self-reported spirituality interacted such that at a given level of one, an increase in the other increased the likelihood of reporting the behavior. You can sort of follow from the top left to the bottom right in each of these grids and see that pattern. Those of high religiosity and high spirituality differed from those of low religiosity and low spirituality at a statistically significant level on every behavior, and with respect to every opinion about how appropriate these behaviors are. I'm not showing you that data here. And even after adjusting for differences in doctors' religious affiliation and physicians' other demographic and practice characteristics, particularly telling, I think, is the fact that physicians of high religiosity and spirituality were three times as likely as those of low religiosity and spirituality to say that they often inquire about religious and spiritual issues. So three times as likely to say they often inquire. And they're almost three times as likely also to say that they never change the subject when religious and spiritual issues come up. So they're talking more frequently, they don't change the subject when it comes up. And despite that, they're also more than three times as likely, 63% versus 18%, to say that they spend too little time discussing religious and spiritual issues with patients. Remember that when Elsie returned to the office, underlined a few of the bits from the last slide, he looked tired and sad. Tearful, not sleeping well, can't concentrate or enjoy anything, also anxious, any bells going off for the clinicians in the room? Raises the question of diagnosing depression or anxiety, or at least adjustment disorder with suppressed mood. And the question is, how should the doctor respond to these reports of his, these symptoms? And what might the doctor's religious practices and commitments have to do with how she responds? The second domain we look at is the differences in how doctors respond to basic mental health concerns. Back in the 2003 study, we included this vignette. A patient presents to you with continued deep grieving 2 months after the death of his wife. If you were to refer the patient, to which of the following would you prefer to refer first? And we found that, and I just showed the data here for religious attendance, this was consistent with other measures. The more religious a physician, the less likely they were to say they would refer to a psychiatrist or psychologist, and conversely, the more likely they were to say they would refer the patient to a clergy member or other religious counselor. When we published this, reviewers pointed out several weaknesses and limitations of this item. One is that the religious characteristics of the patient are not described. And a lot of doctors have reported to me that that would matter for them, that if the patient, that they would want to operate, someone brought it up in the last session too, they want to kind of respond to the patient's lead and what the how the patient's spiritual life is oriented and encourage that if that was something important to them, but not if it was not. Second problem is that we force a choice. So we don't know whether this is a bias against psychiatry or psychology, or if it's a bias in favor of religious resources, clergy members and chaplains. And it's just one scenario. Maybe it'd be different in other scenarios. So we decided to study this further. In 2009, we surveyed about 900 primary care physicians, 312 psychiatrists, these representative samples from the U.S. And in that, we included some measures that had experimental vignette design. So here I'm showing you one of the vignettes we put in, this one for depression. We had a parallel vignette for anxiety. All the people got one vignette. They didn't see all this detail, but we experimentally varied whether they got a vignette in which the patient reported problems with his marriage or work, or no problems, just as a measure of severity of their symptoms, whether the patient was a Christian or Jewish, whether the patient said he rarely attended church or attended synagogue or regularly attends church or regularly attends synagogue. And after this vignette, rather than forcing a choice in either or, we listed several possible responses that the physician might recommend, among which were prescribe an antidepressant, meet regularly with the patient for counseling, refer the patient to a psychiatrist, and encourage the patient to get more involved in the patient's religious community. So what did we find? Interestingly, among primary care physicians, with respect to this depression vignette, there was no religion-associated difference in the likelihood of the physician prescribing an antidepressant. There was no religion-associated difference either in the likelihood of the physician meeting with the patient regularly for counseling. These are two bread-and-butter responses to mild depression. However, primary care physicians who attended services, religious services, twice a month or more often, were less likely to refer to a psychiatrist compared with less frequent attenders. So you see an odds ratio of 0.7. And they were more likely to encourage the patient to get more involved in his or her religious community. 33% would recommend that versus 17% among those who rarely or never attend religious services. Importantly, whether the patient, I found this fascinating, whether the patient was Jewish or Christian did not impact physicians' recommendations, nor did whether or not the patient attended religious services regularly. So despite people thinking that would make a difference, it didn't seem to make a difference when doctors faced the vignette. And there was no interaction between the physician's religiosity and the patient's religiosity. So in other words, this effect of physician religiosity that you see here was not different for religious patients than it was for a religious patient than it was for a less religious patient. Just as one further illustration, here's a portion of the paper analyzing the anxiety vignette. These are, what you see here, are adjusted odds ratios in the right column. And you see that whether or not the patient regularly attended religious services had no effect on what physicians say they would recommend to the patient. Whereas physicians who regularly attended religious services were significantly more likely to say they would encourage the patient to get more involved in her religious community. Notably, with respect to anxiety, we did not find a significant difference in the likelihood of referring to a psychiatrist. Which to me suggests that this finding is probably not a very strong finding, it's not a very stable, maybe not a very stable finding. Okay, back to our clinical case. LC goes through chemotherapy, his disease progresses, he sees his primary physician and he says, Doctor, I do not want to languish and suffer in the final stages of this disease. If I come to the point at which I cannot tolerate living any longer, and if I ask you to do so, would you sedate me until I am unconscious and keep me that way until I die? At a later visit, he adds, it's very important for me to have some autonomy and control at the end of my life. I don't expect I'll need to use it, but would you provide me a prescription for medicines that I can take to end my life if I cannot go on? Elsie's requests bring up the third domain, morally controversial interventions. In 2003, we asked physicians to note if they objected to any of the following medical practices, and if they did object, whether their objection was for religious reasons, reasons unrelated to religion, or both. It's several practices listed there here. I'm going to focus in for the vignette on the ones at the end of life, where PAS here identifies physician-assisted suicide. TS was an abbreviation for terminal sedation, a term I would not use where I'm writing this paper today, but we wrote on the survey agent was sedation to unconsciousness in dying patients. And the third, WLS, is withdrawal of artificial life support. What we found was that doctors who were more religious, however measured, were markedly more likely to report objections both to physician-assisted suicide and to sedation to unconsciousness in dying patients. But there's another interesting finding with respect to affiliation. Roughly one in five Protestants, Catholics, Muslims objected to sedating dying patients to unconsciousness, 43%, so more than twice as many, Hindus did. And we kind of wondered why would that be? We, in our ignorance, we came up with the best hypothesis we could come up with, which was that perhaps this finding reflects the influence of some Hindu traditions and writings that discourage measures that would unduly sedate or impair the clarity, the mental clarity, of a person at the time of death, because of concern that the individual has sufficient opportunity to expunge or to sort of deal with karma in preparation for the next life. In our 2010 study of differences in practices at for patients with advanced illness and at the end of life, we studied a little over 1,100 primary care physicians and subspecialists, with oversampling among those specialties that care for a lot of patients who die, such as critical care docs and oncologists. And we oversampled physicians in the U.S. We used a method that a colleague developed in the U.S. Using typical Asian and Arabic surnames to overset the doctors with those surnames in order to try to include more Hindus and Muslims and Buddhists in the study. And in that study, we included this vignette. KD is a 62-year-old woman dying at home from metastatic lung cancer. Her pain has been treated with high-dose, long-acting narcotics. Her dyspnea has been treated with a combination of oxygen, narcotics, and intermittent nebulizer treatments. Katie tells her physician that her pain and dyspnea are well controlled, but she is distressed at the constant thought of her impending death. She says, I know I'm going to die. I just cannot tolerate lying here thinking about it day after day. Katie asks her physician to sedate her to unconsciousness until she dies. After this vignette, physicians were asked, in your judgment, how appropriate would it be in this case for Katie's physician to sedate her to unconsciousness until she dies? And the first thing we found here was that most physicians in the U.S. object to what's called palliative sedation when we specify that the sedation is aimed at making the patient unconscious and keeping them unconscious until they die. The 72% of physicians believe it would be not very or not at all appropriate to grant Katie's request for sedation. 85% agreed with the statement, unconsciousness is an acceptable side effect of palliative sedation but should not be directly intended. But picking up the earlier observation about Hindu doctors, Hindu affiliation was again significantly associated with opinions and practices in this area. So Hindu physicians were less likely, 20% versus 30% of those with no religion in this case, less likely to believe it's appropriate to grant KD's request. And they are also less likely to agree with the statement that doctors should sometimes treat the psychological and spiritual suffering of terminally ill patients by sedating the patient to unconsciousness. Back to Elsie. Elsie's physician tells us that although she's willing to treat his symptoms aggressively, accepting unconsciousness as an unintended side effect, she is unwilling to intentionally sedate Elsie to unconsciousness until he dies. She's not sure how much of her concern comes from her religious faith and how much comes from what she was taught about the rule of double effect in her introductory ethics course. Either way, she cannot in good conscience do what Elsie requests. So, if that's the case, what should she do? What should she say? That brings up the fourth domain: conscience, directive counsel, and the doctor's way. In our 2003 study, we asked doctors, if a patient requests a legal medical procedure, but the patient's physician objects to the procedure for religious or other moral reasons, A, would it be ethical for the physician to plainly describe to the patient why he or she objects to the requested procedure? 63% of U.S. physicians said yes, that would be ethical. B, does the physician have an obligation to present all possible options for the patient, including information about obtaining the requested procedure? 86% of physicians in the U.S. said yes, they have that obligation. And C, does the physician have an obligation to refer the patient to someone who does not object to the requested procedure? 71% of physicians said yes, they're obligated to refer. Doctors who are more religious on one of several measures, here I'm showing the one for religious attendance, who are more likely to believe it's ethical for doctors to describe their objections to the patient, and less likely to believe doctors are obligated to disclose all possible options, including information about how to obtain the requested procedure, less likely to believe doctors are obligated to refer. And that was particularly true for Christian physicians, whether Protestant or Catholic. This stirred some controversy. It was sort of, the issue is there under the surface, but this brought it a bit more to the surface. And a lot of the debate has since focused on really this third item. The question, does the physician have an obligation to refer the patient for a procedure to which the physician objects, has some moral objection? I think it's been well accepted, at this point anyway, across the board that most people don't want doctors to be forced to do the practice themselves, whatever it is. But a lot of people believe that this is basic professional commitment that the referral be made. And so you have the kind of two sides here. One side saying this is a core part of our professional ethics to make a referral. And another side saying, well, what if the doctor believes that referring is immoral? Then what do they do? So we asked that specific question in another study. I did this with a colleague, John Tilbert, at the Mayo Clinic, a large survey of physicians on a series of topics he was interested in. But we included this question, this one item. We found that 57% of doctors agree that physicians have a professional obligation to refer patients for all legal medical services for which the patients are candidates, even if the physician believes that such a referral is immoral. I tried to put it as plainly as we could. So the majority, but you can still see quite divided, 57% versus 43%. Whereas 57% overall agree, we find a trend in every case of significant differences in the bivariate analysis, trends in the multivariate, just as we expected. More religious doctors are less likely to agree that referrals are obligated. And what was particularly striking was this measure of theological pluralism, which was assessed by agreement or disagreement of three statements. There's truth in one religion, different religions have different versions of the truth, and each may be equally right in its own way, and there is no one true right religion. So a pluralist, a person who's high on theological pluralism would agree that there's no one true right religion. and they would agree that different groups have different ideas about the truth, but each is kind of equally right in some way, and they would disagree that there is truth in one religion. We found that the more pluralistic doctors are, the more likely they are to agree that doctors are obligated to refer. We went on in this subject area to explore doctors' ideas about the extent to which they should influence patients' clinical decisions at all. And here a study of USOBGYNs. In that study, we found that those who are more theologically pluralistic are more likely to believe that with respect to either typical or morally controversial medical decisions, we asked those separate questions separately, more likely to believe that physicians should provide all relevant facts without trying to influence the patient's decision one way or another. Primary care physicians in a different study who were more religious were more likely to believe that physicians are never obligated to do what they believe is wrong. All right, that's the survey, a snapshot. Now I want to think about those findings and suggest why we shouldn't be surprised and why I propose to you that we should think of religious commitments and practices and the practice of medicine as being implicated in one another, that you can't pull this apart. Now, the title of the lecture was, "What does religion have to do with the practice of medicine?" Note that you don't ever hear anyone ask, "What does science have to do with the practice of medicine?" They don't ask that any more than they ask, what do tools have to do with carpentry? Science is what makes medicine work. And largely as a result of modern science, we see graphs like this one, where people in developed nations now live twice as long as they did just a century ago, and they live with much less disability. But as medical science gives us great capacities, it does not give us the same level of direction. Medical science elucidates a range of technical possibilities, provides information about what we might reasonably expect if we choose one route. We might expect as a consequence of choosing one course of action over another. But science generally, unless we agree on where we want to go and what's important, science doesn't tell us which course to choose. And by making this array of choices possible, scientific innovation exposes disagreements about which of those uses are worthwhile. So, for example, obviously, as we saw already with respect to LC, scientific innovation has created the drugs that can be used for sedation to unconsciousness, but it doesn't tell us anything about whether we should sedate someone to unconsciousness or not. Just got my 5-minute warning. So let me see here. Okay. I'll just do this the second one. So in our research, we find that you've got, with respect to an array of controversial interventions, doctors' opinions and practices are more strongly associated with their religious characteristics than with all their other measured characteristics combined. But it seems to me that these morally controversial, visibly controversial characteristics are probably tips of proverbial icebergs. That underneath those differences are disagreements about these really basic human questions. What's the meaning of our mortality? What sorts of suffering should we try to alleviate? What might we hope for in the face of death or suffering? And answers to such questions depend on and emerge from deeper frameworks of meaning, which in many cases are religious traditions. Skip past that. I have to go back. One second. In this quote from Sir William Osler, tongue-in-cheek drawing of him, he says that the man of science is in a sad quandary today. He cannot but feel that the emotional side to which faith leans makes for all that is bright and joyous in life. Fed on the dry husks of facts, the human heart has a hidden want which science cannot supply. As a steady diet, it is too strong and meaty, and it hinders rather than promotes harmonious mental metabolism. If you look at the first part of that quote, you'll see some vague references to scripture. Knowledge is of the things we see. The things that are seen are temporal. The things that are unseen, science knows nothing and has at present no means of knowing anything. behind that is a part of what we were talking about in the earlier session, the challenging, measuring spirituality. But religions, among the things they do is they address this hunger for meaning that Osler's noting science leaves us with. They name it. They name the hunger. They explain it. They stoke it. And they address it. So if you connect back to the issue of calling with which we began, religious traditions give accounts of why and how we should respond to those who are sick. Particular accounts. And formative practices. And they spell out an identity, a calling, and that has meaning for health care practitioners and for others who are involved in caring for the sick. Now, here's what I would propose, just a couple of minutes to close here, is that I hope I persuaded you, if you weren't already persuaded, you might have been already, but persuaded you that Elsie's position can't be reasonably thought of as a generic, interchangeable representative of our one biomedical profession. She's more than a mere provider, but that her ideas about what she's up to in her response to LC, about why she's up to it, about what she should be seeking, about what is good is, about which resources should be used when, will be formed by everything that forms her, including her religious tradition, her religious community, her religious practices. And I think one of the things that I would propose medicine would be wise to do is to make that implicit reality explicit and invite discussion, invite clinicians and patients to start to become more articulate about that connection, to be able to talk about it, think about it, challenge one another, have frank and respectful discussions about those connections. Connect with these deeper questions rather than just arguing on an abstract level about rights and responsibilities without getting to these deeper questions. That's what a conference like this, I think, can do. This is the flyer for the third annual conference on medicine and religion, which basically aspires to follow you guys. We do our fourth, we're going to come later and do our fourth. You do your fifth, we'll do our fifth, hopefully. Next year's will be in Boston. We'd love to have those of you who are able to join us, but it's a context for making that, looking at the substance of religious faith and practice, and particularly Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and asking how those traditions and practices inform what we're doing today and shape the way we go about our care and how they challenge the conventional wisdom that shapes medicine today. And I'll stop there and take any questions.
We have very, very interesting representation. I think it raises a lot of important questions just about, it's also not just our religion, but all the things that we bring ourselves into our mission. But I had a question. So you offered the option of referral to psychiatrist or a religious leader. Oh, have you done anything looking at a referral to a chaplain versus a religious leader? And
yeah, that's a good question. And it's embarrassing, but I'm trying to remember if we did have a separate category in that 2010 study for referral to chaplain.
So the reason I raise that is because, especially within the healthcare setting, chaplains are trained to address some of those issues, and maybe, I just think it would be an interesting thing to do, especially now that there's more education about what chaplains do, whether they would be that referral. And that goes along with your case of LC. I can't remember exactly what the patient said, but it was your very initial slide of why is God doing this to me, or why is God punishing me? You know, what would the physician respond to in that case? And I was on a panel where the physician said, oh, I would say that God is so good and there's no need to worry. And of course, the chaplain on the panel said, well, but I think you need to explore that before you provide an answer that shuts out the conversation. So I think it's really important to be thinking about, yes, we have an involvement, but at what level and who else to bring in on the team.
Yeah.
I agree.
I agree. And I'll just one brief comment in that respect, which is that insofar as doctors, this is my opinion, I'm 98% sure it's true, but that is that insofar as doctors seek to engage religious and spiritual concerns with patients, referrals of chaplains are going to go up.
So I think they will,
because what I observe is that right away people get over their head and they got people got to see, and so they start to identify real need, real issues that have just been going below the surface. And once they're identified, they start looking for people to help them. I think what's happens right now is that the default is that the doctors very rarely ask about these things. And so we don't refer to chaplains because the subject never comes up. Unless someone's dying. And then everybody gets a chaplain visit when they're dying. Another question or comment?
Iván Germana from Indonesia. After it is a very interesting presentation, since I'm also a GP in Indonesia, and I started thinking about how to link it to Donia's presentation about how to put spirituality care in educational setting. So how do you comment on that? To prepare for the physician to start thinking of putting this religiosity or spirituality into practice, and how it does have you ever how did as it work in US in a kind of moment?
Well, as George Pichet commented, there's a lot of different ideas about spiritual assessment. I would say among physicians, our studies have found that very few are following any kind of clear habit or pattern. I mean, very few are using any one of the instruments as a proportion. And what they're doing is kind of responding when something comes up that triggers, like maybe the patient has a Bible on their table, maybe the patient is praying on the floor when they come in, or their family member is. Maybe the patient is weeping, or the patient's getting a diagnosis. There's some trigger that leads to a question. What I, how to train this is a big issue. But I think one word I would say about it is that doctors will not learn until they start to try. So they won't learn by going to a classroom and learning a strategy and then applying it. I've not seen that. They need some tools to get started, but then they've got to practice just waiting out there and taking the risk of asking questions and listening and being slow to speak and finding out who the chaplains are, what their names are, and so I encourage people, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to mess up. It's okay to mess up. It's okay to offend somebody if it happens because you're not trying to offend somebody, you're trying to learn how to care well for them. So that's just a start.
Hi, Farf. Many thanks. You and Kelly, I found your presentation fascinating. I wonder if you could say anything about the implications of your study for medical education in terms of formation and self-awareness. So,
So that gives me a chance to go to another slide. In the U.S., there has, because of those different movements, it's now a part of the accreditation requirements for medical schools to train students to be conscious and aware of how their own moral commitments and practices and so on shape their practices in medicine on some level. But it hasn't gone a lot past that. And I find that the education, this is Harold Koenig may mention tonight, is because he studied it recently, is all over the board, and it still remains pretty marginal in the medical curriculum. Here's an idea from one of my colleagues at Duke, which is that he proposes that what medical educators should do is concede that the formation of good physicians is requires more than they are able to provide, and that because of the hidden curriculum and all these dynamics that erode physician morale, that erode their empathy, and so on, they should welcome this particular communities to be engaged in forming their people to be good physicians, good nurses, and so on. Even if those are religious communities, and even if they're doing that in the explicit terms, and stories, and practices, and theology of those communities. I think he's right.
Thank you.
Ronan Hefty, I wonder what the main differences you find between the religious traditions. This might be another talk on that.
Yeah, that is another talk. I think what's been striking in our work so far is that, I think this probably says a lot about the way our living in a shared world shapes us in shared ways. So the aspects of culture in the U.S. or culture in the West that are shared are more dominant in the differences in the different traditions than what we found certainly in practicing medicine. We find the differences between traditions to be much smaller than the differences between those who are not religious at all and those who are more religious. Another way to put that. But you do find differences. I showed you the difference that Hindus seem to have a particular caution about sedating patients at the end of life, or at least are more likely to have that caution. We find that Muslim physicians, this has not been so much found in our quantitative research, but found through conversations with the members, Muslim physicians, members of the Muslim community in the U.S. From the Shia community, there's a strong concern about withdrawing artificial life support. It's not the same, quite the same in the Sunni community. Same with the Orthodox. Certain communities of Orthodox Jews are very hesitant to withdraw life-sustaining treatment in a way that is not true as much for Christians and for Sunni Muslims. This would require a lot more conversation, but those are just some of the findings.
Thank you for a very interesting talk. It's Jackie Watts from the Open University in the UK. Drawing on some of the medical sociology literature, we learn increasingly about the empowerment of patients and the reduction in paternalism of doctors. I mean, that's a very broad statement. I just wondered whether you could say a bit more about the power relations that may exist in the patient-physician encounter in the context of palliative care, where patients perhaps are particularly vulnerable and where they may almost feel obliged to participate in an exchange about spirituality and their spiritual needs and spiritual care, when perhaps they don't know how to do that, or they may not be ready to do that.
Well, you put it well. The power differential is intrinsic to the doctor-patient relationship insofar as the patient is sick. There are some patients who are not particularly sick, but are looking for a service of some sort, in which case I don't think the power differential is not really the same kind of concern. Certainly someone who's sick enough to be getting palliative care is in a drastically reduced position power. And yes, that highlights the sensitivity with which the physician or anyone else must go about conversation with the patient about spiritual concerns. But I would encourage us to remember, A, that power differential is there, period. It's not something that's specific to talking about spiritual issues. And what I see in our world of medicine, in the U.S. at least, is the notion that because there's a power differential, doctors should be non-directive and passive. Because if they were to be directive, that would have a strong influence, thereby then be leaning toward paternalism and potential coercion. I suggest that that's the wrong way to think about it. Because the power differential is inevitable, the answer is not for doctors to be non-directed, it's for them to develop wisdom and to develop the right sort of habits that are fitting for a relationship where there's differential power, but to use that influence well for the patient's good. I think it highlights why we need good physicians and good nurses rather than just good techniques or strategies of not being directed with each other. And people use their power well.